So hello and welcome. My name is Steve Pugh. I do something called a Growth Strategy Podcast, where I introduce you to really interesting people that I think are either just worth knowing, or they're really good for your business or career, or just other generally good people and stories and stuff that we want to share. So Ali today, who I'm going to introduce you to, we met about a year ago, give or take, which we'll discuss. Really great lady. I'm going to let her discuss. One of the things that I've learned over the past 100 or so episodes is to let people describe themselves in their own words, just because it's very easy, well-intentioned, to put your foot in it as well. But if you join us for the next kind of 40 minutes or so, you're going to meet someone that's really special, that's trying to do really kind of cool stuff. She's a social media kind of expert, content creator. I noticed through looking through her Instagram or Facebook, I think you've got a few paid things as well, which is quite cool. I know people will be interested in. And yeah, it's just a really great person that we're going to kind of talk about. And we're going to talk about disability awareness and lots of really kind of cool stuff as well. So, Ali, everyone can now see you and hear you.
Hello, hello.
How's your Monday been?
It is really good, actually. Despite all the bad weather, I'm having a great day.
So with what you've been up to, I was going to say this week, but like, so we haven't spoken for 2 months or so. You know, well, what have you been up to lately?
Oh, quite a lot. I was up in London the week before last at Mansion House, which is really incredible, beautiful place, which was built for the mayor after the big fire that happened in London way back when. Beautiful building. So I was doing a speech then, which was really good. It was for the Snowden Trust, which is an incredible charity that I received a scholarship from. Wow. And then more recently, today, I found out that the football team that I play for, we have officially won the league. So I'm in a great mood.
That's because so I play basketball. And we have our last game of the season. I think generally sports seasons for what winter sports end about now. So we've got training on Wednesday and our last game of the season is Thursday. And if we win, we win the league. And if we don't, well, who cares? But it's that balance. I always find it funny though, is because I used to be mega passionate about sport when I was younger and I was first team captain at basketball and stuff at uni. As well now, I just kind of play for fun. I don't really care if we win or lose. And it's, but I still appreciate anyone that, you know, is part of a kind of awkward kind of awesome social football team type thing. So if you were to give a quick introduction to people that might not know who you are, how would you almost, can you give a quick kind of 60 second intro?
Yeah, absolutely. So I have been a content creator and influencer predominantly on Instagram for the past 6 years and worked with over 100 incredible brands such as like Unilever, Sky, every fashion brand probably that you can think of, Gymshark, loads of cool brands. And then as well as that, during my career, I've been head of marketing for a company. And then I transitioned into the charity sector and I work in sort of marketing and digital storytelling, which is so much fun.
So we met, it was to do with Purple Sock Day, which burned into my memory as the 3rd of December last year. And so with what I always like to do on the interviews is that it's great to go into the content bit to kind of talk about different areas of expertise. But one of the things that I love about kind of longer form content is for people to get to know you a little bit more and your backstory and that kind of thing. Because although you're a little bit younger than I am, when I was growing up, it was really hard to really figure out what jobs are out there, how they work and that kind of thing. But then likewise, people from different backgrounds, you know, I've been doing a lot of customer research at the moment too, with the roadmap stuff. And one of the big things that people always are now looking for is mentorship, to really understand what routes could I take? What are people similar to me? What did they do? And like kind of related to that is that I know that when I was at school, I didn't really know what I wanted to do, that kind of thing. So I always like to go back and, you know, find out a bit more about the person, what they like growing up, what they're like at school. But it's always with the aim that there might be people that are eight's a bit young, 15, 18, 21, 25, 55 now, they go, oh, I quite like the sound of that, you know. So where did you grow up?
So I grew up, and I'm still there, just outside of Brighton, about half an hour from Brighton, along the southeast coast.
No, oh, cool. And then with, I'm guessing you went to school?
I did indeed.
Where I'm kind of going with that is that what were you like at school? Were you one of the cool kids, naughty kids, sporty kids?
Oh, I think I was a bit of an all-rounder, to be honest. I was very sporty, but my friendship group weren't. So there was a distinct moment where I was putting like gifted and talented for PE. And I said, move me out of this. None of my friends are here. Put me back down. So I was very sporty, but kind of didn't embrace that as much as I could have. I was quite studious. I was quite academic. I would say I was one of those people, I'd leave an essay until the day before, but it probably still get very good marks. So I think I had a bit of a natural gift with sort of academics, which was great and very lucky. Friendship wise, kind of got on with everyone, just kind of floated about, had a lot of friends, but was never like, you know, one of the clique.
It's funny though, isn't it? Because every school has them. And actually, ironically, even a lot of workplaces have them. And it's a really funny thing that I still, when I look back, I don't know that I enjoyed school. I think part of it, I used to get bullied for having like non-brand trainers and stuff like that. And I think that, you know, that kind of played a big part of it. But the one thing that kind of got me was that because I was short-sighted, but it was never picked up. Because I always thought it made sense that stuff further away was blurry. To me, it made sense. So I never said anything because I thought that was just normal. But because of that, when you'd sit at the back of the class, I'd soon lose interest because I couldn't really see what was going on anyway. But it was almost, I was never maliciously disruptive, but I kind of was a little bit. And one of the things that I've kind of noticed is that a lot of entrepreneurs and people that do their own thing often have that slightly rebellious streak in them, because often you have to, or you don't have to, but often entrepreneurs kind of challenge the status quo, that they kind of, they see how things work, but you think, oh, you know what, I could do it better. Or how about this? So after you kind of went through school, and I believe you went to uni?
I did, yeah.
What did you go on to do?
So for my undergrad, I did a Bachelor of Science in Economics.
No, that's very cool. It's very cool. And then as you kind of went through uni, how did you find the whole experience?
Oh, it was, I say it now looking back sort of, you know, 10 years on from when I started, it was the best and worst experience of my life. Like, it was great because for me, so I'd became ill at 17. So I was predominantly housebound for the best part of my second year of A-levels. So I was studying from home. I was really isolated. And then for some reason, I don't know why, don't ask me why, but I thought going to uni is a great idea. I'll do that. And I went, and suddenly I had all of this freedom, all of this independence, all of these people around me. And so it was great because that's what I'd been wanting and really needing for that past year. But it was also awful because then I really neglected my health. And obviously that physical health was a struggle. And then it barrels into mental health and you are suddenly around a lot of alcohol. And, you know, it's not the healthiest environment, I think.
It's funny when, so now it's not that I don't drink, but I don't drink much. Mm-hmm. So on Saturday night with the film, I watched the new Chris Hemsworth thing on Netflix. Anyway, I had 3 beers, but for me, that's the first time I drank in like a month. But at uni, again, sports team, you kind of laddie stuff, we used to drink like a lot. And you think, how did I even survive on some of it? But it's crazy how hangovers change from when you're kind of invincible at 18, 19, 20. Like I'm 39, I'm 40 in about 2 months' time. And they just kill you now. It's one of those things. It's like a 2-3 day hangover.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I remember there was 1 week that I went out every night, like from Sunday to the following Sunday. So I went out 8 nights in a row. Don't even know how that I was on a Sunday because there was nothing. I think I crashed someone's work Christmas party. It was the Wetherspoons work Christmas party. I didn't even work there, but somehow got into it. And now, like, even the idea of just going out for dinner 8 nights in a row, let alone going out drinking, I'd be like, no, that's too much for me.
But good fun. But what I always find quite funny is that I've got my cousin's son. So I think technically my second cousin has gone to do engineering at Sheffield. So he's gone to exactly the same place I did 20 years ago. But the point is, for different people, I think uni performs a different function. So for instance, for some people, it's academic and you need to learn and grow, which I kind of was me. But also it's a great environment to kind of find yourself and almost grow up and find out who you want to be in the world and get exposed to all these different cultures and people. That, you know, I grew up in Liverpool and actually the population was 99% white. And it was just, I only knew people from that, you know, our hometown. So it was a really great experience for me just to kind of open my eyes to different people, different cultures, different languages. And it was because of that I grew up a hell of a lot from the age of, I don't know, 18 to say 24, because I did some extra stuff. But it was just, I think it, different people need different things, is where my second cousin Josh is like straight A student, aced everything. But maybe for him, it's the life experience. So it's going out 9 times. I know he doesn't like going out, But the point is, it's that life experience of just doing stuff, being away from home, being away from parents, being away from anything. I think it's quite important. You mentioned about how when you kind of got sick at 17, would you be happy to kind of talk about that? Because I know it's a theme that kind of runs through.
Yeah, so when I was 17, I'd literally just turned 17, and I was really active at that point. Like, I was always kicking a ball around, and I had a job delivering leaflets over the summer. So I was really active. I think I can't tell you how many miles I was walking a day, but it was a lot because I had to hand out all these leaflets. And I then got a virus, and it was just like a sickness bug. And I thought, okay, great, you know, not great, but I'll take a week and I'll be fine. And then I just never recovered from it. And, you know, the first sort of few weeks, it was just that real heavy fatigue that you have after any sort of flu or sickness and stuff like that. And then it just didn't go away. And so the whole of the summer, I was just like, couldn't move. I felt like my body was just dunked in cement. Everything felt so heavy. I felt so nauseous. I felt so tired. And yeah, it sort of took 6 months to get diagnosed. And then I was diagnosed with ME, which is the equivalent of like chronic fatigue syndrome, fibromyalgia, which is chronic widespread pain. So although it had taken 6 months for that diagnosis, obviously it was great to have it, but unfortunately there wasn't really any treatment at that point, sort of 11 years ago.
So like, how, as a 17-year-old, did that start to like almost impact your life? You know, how, because what I'm trying to do is almost just understand, if I can, like, you know, what changed, what happened, you know, just in terms of stuff that you were doing before that maybe was a bit harder, because obviously that's going to impact, I guess, your schoolwork, your social life, everything.
Yeah, it completely changed my life almost, I would say overnight, but it a period of a few weeks, I think it really changed it, especially then when it got to a point that I thought, I'm not getting better from this. You start to have those thoughts after a couple of weeks and you think something's really not right here. For me, so I was doing my second year of A-levels and I had to stop physically going to college because I just couldn't leave the house. I was so weak, like I struggled to lift a glass of water because it was so heavy, my muscles just couldn't do it. And then in terms of social life, I think I felt very isolated at the time, and I felt quite resentful at the time of, you know, where have all my friends gone? Why aren't they here? Why don't they care? But obviously looking back at it now that I'm a lot older, I can just see that I think at 17, no one's really prepared for that, and no one understands, and everyone's in their own little bubble of everything they've got going on and thinking about starting to go out and go to university. And I think I kind of just got forgotten about because I wasn't there. But it was really difficult, and I think it really affected my mental health, and I struggled a lot with depression because of that.
Because I know the one of the things you're really passionate and you kind of campaign for is about hidden disabilities.
Yeah.
For people that might not know the term, what does that mean, and what are some examples?
So I think when we think of disabled, obviously we think of that typical image of a wheelchair user. And there's a, even though you may not be able to necessarily see their disability, there's a real visual clue there. And I think a lot of disabilities you can't see when you look at a person. So at the time when I was 17, I had to start using a mobility aid. So I started using a walking stick. But for me now, if I stood up and did a twirl, you wouldn't be able to see kind of anything quote unquote wrong with me. But obviously I've got a lot going on health wise. So I think what's really important about that is just remembering that there's not one type of disability, there's hundreds, and you can't necessarily see all of them. Sometimes you can see sort of the symptoms and side effects, like you might be able to see that someone's tired or see that someone's shaky or struggling on their feet, but often we can't see the disability, and there's a lot going on that we kind of don't know about when we look at people.
Because I think it's, as you get a little bit older, I try and call myself out on stuff, and it's again when I do this, and in theory it's some sort of kind of platform, I always try and give examples of stuff that we probably all do but we shouldn't. But it's so, prime example, when I go to my local Tesco's, you have disabled parking bays, and you know, someone parks in a Mercedes in the disabled parking bay, but they just get out and walk away, and then you're like, are you disabled? And it's just, it's that kind of thing. But you are completely right that you don't know what's going on with someone, but it's very easy for anyone to judge. And I guess a lot of us do it, but I guess it's not kind of intentioned. So as you kind of finish uni, did you finish uni? I'm pretty sure you did. So then what happened? What did talk us through your career?
So I finished uni and I took the decision. I was like, I need to focus on my health. I need to get myself sorted out. I was in a really bad place mentally. And I was just like, I just need some time to work out what I wanted to do. So whilst I was at uni studying economics, I'd done a year's placement at Goldman Sachs Investment Bank, which was incredible. And like the dream for any one of those students. It was such a coveted position. But because of my health, I was like, I can't do this job. They want me there 7 a.m. till 7 at night. And that's just not feasible when you've got chronic fatigue. So I took a real look at what was important to me. And I just thought, focus on your health. So I started sort of looking after myself, looking more into nutrition, and started doing a little bit of exercise. And I found that because my sole focus was my health, which meant that then I was eating right, I was getting the right amount of sleep, I had a little bit more energy, and I was able to invest that energy into myself and into building my health up. And for me, I found that the gym helped a lot of things. It doesn't for everyone. That's a real caveat. It doesn't for everyone, particularly when you're trying to work and do other things. But for me, I found that I invested into it and I got a lot back from it. So that actually led me to starting to do courses to be a personal trainer. And I was like, that's what I want to do. I want to coach people who've been in this position. So I started doing my PT qualifications, and then I started doing them and it was going great. And then I had a really bad ankle sprain. So then I couldn't do my practical exams, which was obviously a bit of a nightmare. But I'd started during this time sort of documenting my journey on Instagram, and I was starting to build a little bit of a following, and I really enjoyed that. So I then started working with a sportswear company, helping them do their social media whilst also building my own. And then that evolved and got me to a place where I started doing paid partnerships on my Instagram. I grew quite a following. It was going great. I then got a role for an oral care company, working in their social media, and ended up being promoted to the head of marketing. My career is wild, by the way. This is quite a story. I then lost my job due to disability discrimination. This was during the pandemic. So that happened. And then I switched sectors into the charity sector, did a fixed term contract for 8 months with the National Literacy Trust. And then I went and did a master's, which I got a scholarship for, in digital media, culture and society. Came out, went back to freelancing, met you for Purple Sock Day, did some work with Parallel. And now I'm kind of here.
Because I must admit, what I find almost fascinating is that I do want to dig into the whole influencer thing, because it's what I find fascinating is that if you asked, I don't want to generalize, ironically, on Friday, I'm doing a careers day at a local sixth form. So people 16 to 18 come in and talk to different people. I'm going to talk about the roadmap stuff and businesses and whatever. But if you asked a sphere of younger people, influencer is now a career that wasn't, I don't know, 10, 20 years ago. And what I'm always interested in is that how did you get into it? So did you actually approach a brand and say, look, I have this platform, I do this, would you want to do something together where I can promote your products, but actually I believe in them, I use them, and then actually if you pay me X, I will do this and 10 posts a month? Like, I'm just, because there'll be so many people that are really interested and actually they would love to do the same.
Yeah, absolutely. So when I started out, as I was growing my following, I started to get invited to events. Obviously, this is way pre-COVID. So I started to get invited to events. And then because of that, there was like this little network of girls who are also influencers in Brighton who had that similar following. So that was really nice. So then we would start to talk about everything like that. How do you get paid campaigns? Are you getting them? Mm-hmm. There was a lot of gifting at the time. So a lot of brands would reach out and offer you sort of a gift, which is great, but also doesn't pay the bills. And then there was quite a few apps at the time that you could join and they would connect you with brands. So I started by doing that. And then as sort of my following evolved, I would get brands reaching out to me directly, or I could pitch to brands. And then now I'm at a place where I don't really use those apps because they don't appropriately pay influencers from my mind. And particularly, you know, when you think about majority of influencers female and there's a gender wage gap, I think there's some real issues with that. So I don't often use them now, but a lot of my work will come sort of direct to me, which is really interesting because in those early days I pitched so much.
Because I think when I was doing my homework, I went onto your Facebook page And again, the rules changed about 4 years ago, but it was on some of your posts, you know, it had the hashtag ad. And you know, I'm someone that I really love the craft, and I've never gone that route, but I do buy a lot of tech, hence like the room and stuff. So just out of sheer fun, I review stuff that I've bought just because I enjoy making videos. I literally do one take. I stand here and say, oh, da, da, da. I've been sent some free stuff, and it's amazing. It's one of the best things ever because it's like, I didn't have to buy that. But actually, you know, it could be hopefully like a really kind of good career. But by the sounds of it, you did really kind of hustle. You approach people. And I think it's that balance of when I've only recently discovered TikTok. Are you on TikTok?
I am.
So I know 4 years ago it really started to kick off. And I just ignored it and I ignored it and I ignored it. And then 2 years ago, I saw people start to, oh, no, for brands and for businesses, it's really good. I still kept ignoring it. And then officially about 3 weeks ago, I thought, I'm going to finally kind of do it. But one of the things that I really struggled with was it's the different forms of content. Does that make sense? So for this interview, it might be like 50 minutes. So that's one long piece of content. But then likewise, I'll clip it up and it'll turn into like 4 6-minute videos for YouTube. But then I thought, well, actually, but for TikTok, I've watched people use the app and it's literally... So how do you create 1 second, 2 second content to get people? And it's a really difficult kind of skill. So just like from your point of view, how do you go about creating different types of content for different platforms, but in particular TikTok, because I think it's so difficult to do?
Yeah, it's really funny that you mentioned sort of taking a while to jump on the TikTok trend, because when TikTok were first trying to rebrand themselves, this is back when they were called Musical.ly, and everyone just sung along to music, like it was great, and they were trying to rebrand themselves, and they actually paid me to make videos on Musical.ly, which is now TikTok. So wow. I actually had that way back when. I would say the biggest thing is knowing your audience, and your audience will be different across all the channels. So really know your audience, lean into what they like. The analytics of posts will tell you what people are resonating with, and then look at the comments. What questions are being asked? What are people going, yes, this part particularly really engaged me, and just do more of that. I think we can almost overthink with TikTok because there's so many trends and we're like, oh, I want to jump on that. But does it relate to your audience? Like, can you make that work for your audience? And if you can't, you don't need to jump on that.
Because the one thing that always gets me is that so obviously we've been talking about marketing, social media, is that I'm one of these people, I might take a while to get onto it, but I try and execute stuff to a really high standard. And again, so I knew TikTok was on, you know, something that I wanted to do. And I was actually willing to almost pay someone to run it for me because I didn't know what to do. But then actually when I've been digging a little bit deeper, it is harder than people think. But likewise, when you kind of find your momentum, and so one of the things I wanted to do, so the roadmap is about making business education accessible, but it's about real public opinions, real people, and how do you get a connection and hopefully some sort of feedback interaction within like 2 seconds. So one of the things I thought, because I'm actually genuinely interested, is to ask people questions. So about society, about climate change, about student debt, lots of different stuff. But it's a very easy yes, no answer to get an interaction in like 2 seconds as a way, you know, which just hopefully complements different forms and different type of kind of content. But where I was going with that is that you also get a lot of people that say, oh yeah, I'll build your account for you. But you look at their account and they've only done 6 posts and they haven't done anything. And so my point being that I really respect anyone that does a platform and keeps doing it and, you know, is actually good at it, as opposed to you get so many people now that promise to sell the dream but almost kind of, you know, don't walk it through. So almost one of the big things that we've mentioned about was almost hidden disabilities, that kind of thing. Why is that important to you? I know we kind of touched on it before, but it's that balance of where are there communities out there that don't feel heard? You know, I really want to stand and shine a light on it, just because, you know, it's something that I want to almost support more, just as a mission-led kind of organization.
Yeah, absolutely. I think for me, obviously, with my experience, I went from being a very active participant in my own life to almost watching it go past by the sidelines. And I think when we are in a room, an important room, we're in a boardroom, we're in places like this, the people that are the sickest, even like people with ME who have got the most severe types, they are not in that room. So the reason why I continue to campaign, especially as my health has got better over the years, is because I'm doing it for the people who aren't there.
Yeah, okay.
And I think that's really important. I think often we can look around our own lives and think something isn't an issue because we don't see it. And there's a whole group of people that we aren't seeing because they're not able to participate because society is not accessible.
And I think that's one of the, because what's the beauty of when you've got your own platform is I get to pick who the guests are. And it's, I love people that have a mission. And it's that balance of where it'd be so easy for both of us to just do our own thing, screw everyone else. But just when you've got something that you actually genuinely want to do and help, I do find it quite funny that with, it's when people say, oh yeah, what you do isn't needed. And it's like, no, it is. Just because you don't see it doesn't mean it's not a thing. And it often can be, before we went on the call, we were talking about socials, but it can be so difficult to try and champion a cause and talk on a topic and you get no feedback, you get no support, just to keep going. And sometimes it's difficult, sometimes it's not. So what's your dream for the future?
Oh, that's a big one. I think, to be honest, I feel like during the pandemic, everyone gained a lot of perspective and understanding. Everyone realized what it was like to, one, have to think about your health 95% of the time, for that to be a very worrying thought, which consumes a lot of your energy, and two, to be housebound. And I think over sort of the past year, we've lost a lot of that empathy that I think we gained in that perspective. And I would just love to see that come back. I would love to see everyone that is now out and able to socialize and do these things, just to remember the people that are still at home and still struggling. I don't think there's necessarily like one big goal. I think for me, it's about the little things. It's about every day doing something to make someone else feel good, feel heard, feel seen. I think that's what's important.
I think there's something, I actually put a post about it on Saturday, and I've kind of realized that is that when I've, because my career is just as squiggly as yours, it just goes all over the place. But it's for me, it is about the community mission and almost having given back in some ways. That I had lots of chips on my shoulder when I grew up about I wanted to achieve certain things or get certain job titles or buy a certain car or whichever, which my 15-year-old self or 13-year-old self, when I had nothing, I would still do that and I should still do that. But the point is, as I went through my career, I got to the point where actually other things now give me energy and excitement. And that's why I get out of bed every day, that I currently drive a 9-10-year-old car, which has got dents in the doors. But I'm more than happy to do that versus like a posh Mercedes, isn't it? Just because I get my fulfillment and mission through trying to make a change. Does that make sense? And what really kind of comes across is almost the fact that it sounds like you have yours and you have your cause that you want to champion. And some people really spend their whole lives trying to find something to really get behind. Does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's the thing, like I look back at myself and, even just choosing economics to study at university, for me, it was a toffer between that and English literature. And my heart was like, pick English lit. And I was like, what am I going to do with that? I'm not going to make any money. So I picked economics. And then somewhat ironically, now I'm like, not even doing anything to do with that. But it was that thing at like, 16, you're like, well, I want to make money. I want to earn this. I want to have this big house. And it's like, are you asking yourself though, are you going to be happy? Like, that's what matters really.
Yeah. But like with your priorities do change over time and that's okay. And I still, with a lot of the customer feedback stuff I've been doing, I actually think it's unfair and a bit stupid to ask people to set the whole course and direction for their entire life at 14, 15, 16. Because you haven't got Scooby-Doo, what you want to do. But it's almost where that's just the way the school system is set up and there's no reason why it should be. But I also think that the world has changed in a way that now it's easier to pivot your skills, to go into different stuff and try different stuff. That almost that is now arguably the norm versus our parents' generation that probably were in one job for like 30 years. Does that make sense? It's just the way the world has kind of changed. So towards the end of every kind of interview, I have two main questions that I love to ask. The first, if you were to give advice to your younger self, so it could be you at 17 when you first kind of got a bit sick. It could be at any point in your life. If you were to give advice to your younger self, what would it be?
So for me, I would tell myself not to be such a perfectionist. Like, I had it really drilled into me from a young age that anything less than 100% was failure. And it was a really unhealthy, toxic way of growing up. And for me, it took me a long time to let go of that. And even now, I'm still learning how to let go of that. So I would really give myself some encouragement and know that actually your best is good enough. Mm-hmm. And just trying is good enough. It doesn't matter of the outcome.
It's a very inspirational soundbite. I'm definitely going to use that. Out of interest, was it from school or parenting? Or
from my father.
So I was the same. I remember I had a school teacher called Mrs. Coughlin, and I was probably 7 at the time, and that's when I was first told as I was a perfectionist. And it's that balance of where I don't believe I'm kind of autistic, but in my head I constantly iterate and I want to change things and improve things, and it is really, really difficult to know when done is good enough. Does that make sense? And actually I found this when I used to photograph weddings when I was doing my PhD, and I would spend ages to try and craft like the perfect photo and get everything technically. And I'd realize actually when I'd send the bride and groom the pictures, often on as their Facebook profile picture, they had picture perfect wedding photos that were technically perfect. But they probably have a selfie from a night out, which was technically terrible, just because they liked it. And what I realized is that when you're trying to create something, to go from 0 to 90% isn't that difficult. But to go from 90 to 99, 100% is like exponentially harder. But that last 10%, most people don't notice the difference. And the point being, especially for business or careers or anything you're doing, it's very easy to constantly strive for absolute perfection when actually your client often won't even notice. They're probably happy with 80%, and it can be quite a difficult lesson to learn. But I think it's a really important one. So it's cool that you've kind of cracked that one already. The other one as well is that, I've done that one, sorry. I'm struggling to read my sheet. What's the best piece of advice you've ever had?
Oh, that is such a tough one. I think, to be honest, I don't think I get given a lot of advice, maybe because I'm quite headstrong. And I often, when I do share my problems, I often come with like a preset, almost like, here are the 3 paths I could take. Which do you think I should have? I like present my problems with a full-blown presentation, and I've thought of every scenario. So I'm quite an overthinker. But there is a quote which is from Shakespeare's Othello that has always resonated with me. So I'm going to pretend that Shakespeare gave me this advice. I've actually got it tattooed on me, and it's "the robbed that smiles steals something from the thief." So essentially, if someone has taken something from you, you know, that can be literally or it can be figuratively, and you are able to smile, you've actually taken something from them. You've not lost anything, but they have. And I think it's really beautiful, and it's helped me for a lot.
What is it again?
"The robbed that smiles steals something from the thief."
Wow. That's deep. I love doing this just because I get to learn from a lot of different people. But I think people again underestimate that you can have mentors and inspirational people that influence you that was 700 years ago. You know, people I personally don't have any in-person mentors, but I do take inspiration from, you know, just people I see around or books or, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it's really important that people, you know, almost, I guess, find whatever works for you. But the thing that always kind of blows my mind as well is that I think a lot of people assume that people 700 years ago or 1,000 years ago or 10,000 years ago weren't smart. And they were. They were as smart as we are now. They just didn't have thousands of years of learnings to build upon. But occasionally stuff kind of, you know, comes through, and I've been reading a lot of the different philosophers and that kind of thing. And actually, humans are really clever in a lot of different ways. And it's just, how can you tap into that and almost use it for, I guess, good, and to try and, you know, help do things better, bigger, that kind of thing. Is there anything you would like to talk about or plug before we go?
I will plug my LinkedIn. I've been neglecting it a little bit because I've been so busy, but I am working on it and have got some really cool post ideas which are coming up, which are gonna hopefully blow some minds about, particularly about expectations of working and what it's like to be working as someone sort of with chronic illnesses.
Cool. So I guess I will tag you in the post so people can find you that way. I was trying to think through all of the different things that can kind of work. And then where can people follow you on the other socials?
I'm on everything at Ali Hemsley.
Does that include TikTok? I will give you an extra follow.
It does include TikTok. I've also got a secret TikTok account, but we won't be sharing that.
No, cool. Well, thank you. Honestly, thank you for your time today. What I love to do is, you know, I use these to get inspiration and learn from different people. That when you look at your, we both have the ability to craft our jobs and do more of the stuff that we enjoy doing. And I genuinely do enjoy talking to people. But the thing that kind of gets me as well is that when I always try and take an honest approach to the interview, so I ask what's actually on my mind and that kind of thing. And the thing that always kind of gets me, and we said before about it, it's a funny one that often nobody likes or comments, but they still see it. And the thing that kind of gets me is that you get a lot of people who will see this, but they'll take inspiration from you, but they just never tell us. But because of that, I know that it genuinely kind of helps. So I love to pick people and that hopefully just, you know, give back and share a light on some of the stuff that you're doing. I'm certain that we will work together again in the future. We'll kind of stay in touch. Thank you for your time today. And yeah, that's about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
No worries. Well, cheers, Ali. I'll speak to you soon.